The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to gamban.com to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Problem Gambling Podcast. I'm Barry Grant, an addiction counselor with Extern Problem Gambling. And my co-host is Tony O'Reilly, also an addiction counselor with the project and co-author of the book Tony 10. And today we're delighted to have as our guest the head of delivery of education at Epic and the author of the brand new book, Might Bite, which tells his own story of his lived experience of gambling addiction and recovery, Patrick Patch, sometimes called Patch. Patrick Foster, thanks a million for joining us today. How are you doing, sir?
Good, thanks. Thanks so much for having me on. It's good to see you both.
Thanks, man. And thanks for coming on. What part of the world are you in?
I'm in Oxfordshire in the UK. So, yeah, just outside a town called Witney, which is where home is now.
Okay, lovely. Tony, you've had the chance, more of a chance to read Patrick's book than I have. What are your initial thoughts? I know we're just before we started recording there, you were saying that sometimes reading other people's kind of lived experiences can be a bit challenging for you, obviously, from your own perspective of lived experience. What are your initial thoughts and the book? Yeah,
brilliant. I suppose, yeah, as I was saying before we start to record, when I'm reading other people's books and their lived experience, it can be a bit, I wouldn't say draining might be the word I'd use, but it could definitely bring up. And I remember I texted Patrick, having read the first chapter, and just said I can relate to so much in it. And I knew it was going to be one of those reads that kind of bring me back probably to a little bit of my own journey. And it starts in March 2018, fairly full on into it. I think it starts March 2018, then goes backwards and then builds right back up to March 2018 again. And there was one bit in it, and Patrick might even maybe expand on it a bit, where he's sitting in the classroom and he's waiting on Might Bite to win a race to win nearly 200,000 sterling. And the one bit that got me when he was describing that was just, you know, sitting there on top of the classroom, you know, pretending everything else is okay and this thing is going on under your nose and you're waiting on this horse to win and you have to act totally normal after this horse loses. Now, I never realized Might Bite, the name of the book, was a horse, because I haven't been, I suppose I don't know much about horse racing anymore, thankfully. I probably never knew a whole lot about it anyway. But I think because I'm so dissociated from it, I didn't even know that Might Bite was the name of a horse. So I was a bit taken back when I read that. But that moment when you're sitting in the classroom and it loses, and then you're kind of just that, it just brought me right back to that wave of so many bets that could have got you out of trouble. And just that feeling of just pure dejection. Now, we'll have listeners in who may not have gambling addiction or disorder of gambling, but I think for anyone who has been impacted, when that, you know, when you feel that this is going to change my life or this is going to fix everything, and then it loses, and then you have to put on a face in front of other people, whether it's loved ones or in your case students or probably a mixture of both, it really brought me back to many of those weekends where I nearly quite got it back. And it was that one last goal in the last minute, or that one horse that might have quite got there. And I suppose that set the tone really for the book, because, you know, it really grabs the reader straight in, which it did with me. And as I said, I texted you straight away and said, oh my God, I'm after connecting right back to that bit. So you might just maybe elaborate on that bit of it, just for people who might know the story.
Yeah, absolutely. You've just hit the nail on the head there with what you said with regards to that feeling. At that point, it had almost got to a matter of kind of life or death or make or break. And watching it, knowing that, was extraordinary. But I think my reaction to that situation said a lot, because you'd think watching that race, you'd be sitting there going mad, even if there were other people there shouting at the TV or the computer screen, as it was for me. But actually, it wasn't like that at all. I just watched it all unfold. And when it finished, it was, well, that's just the consequences of it. But the hardest bit was to then just pretend like nothing had happened, knowing what I was knowing. And I will never forget the 20 minutes that I stood at the back of the classroom. Pupils were all sort of doing some work, and I just stared out the window. And that 20 minutes felt like 2-3 hours. It went so slowly, and so much going through my mind, but yet so little at the same time. Time just stood still. And it's so hard to describe, but as you say, it's amazing how as a gambling addict, you have the ability to just turn it on and off like a tap. Anybody who doesn't have a problem with it, I think, would be very emotional one way or another, either euphoric or devastated. But as a gambling addict, you just find a way to make it seem to everybody else like nothing has happened, because you've become so accustomed to just living this lie and living a kind of life of disguise and mystery.
Yeah, and that can also happen with big wins as well, because you can't, or you feel like you can't, or you don't show the emotion either. There's been plenty of times when I had that big win, and it's nearly like the same reaction. You're just kind of, you know, the laptop might just go down, but it's a different sense. Sometimes it's a sense of relief, but I remember for one or two situations, I'm sure you're the same, it's kind of going, oh, I have to continue to do this. So, you know, like, we'll often hear with people who we work with saying that it's not about the win or lose, it's about A, being in action, and B, like, what the feeling to get wilder in action. But it sometimes the reaction to the big loss can be nearly, not quite the same, but nearly the same as the reaction to a big win. It's not that outpouring of emotion. It's just a lot of time it's relief. A lot of time it's kind of, oh no, I have to go again. Even though you know that you're so deep in it, sometimes it can be just so overwhelming just to think that you have to stay going back at it. And while reading from that chapter, from the first chapter of March 2018, it goes right back. And when I was kind of journeying with you on your gambling journey, it's just so many moments where it was just so overwhelming. Like, I was getting even anxious reading it, looking at the amount of times you were, you know, you were in debt, you were getting more debt. And I was trying to get my head around what it was like, that kind of constant anxiety, constant stress of being kind of, you know, trying to sort one thing to figure out another thing. And it really, I think the early chapters, I'm up to 2016 now, I think, in the book. I still have to go, like I'm working my way through it very slowly. But it's going in that journey from, I think it was 2006 when it kind of started, wasn't it? As far as I remember. And then going from that right up, it's I got that sense of anxiety. I was dragged right into your narrative and your story. So maybe to give people who may not have a chance to kind of know your story, maybe just start, maybe give a brief synopsis of that time.
Yeah. As you just said, I started gambling in 2019. Unlike a lot of people nowadays, particularly young people, gambling wasn't part of my life at all. When I was younger, I wasn't really exposed to it. It wasn't something that was part of kind of upbringing or family. And I was at university when I first placed a bet, like a lot of people. It was something that some of my kind of new mates were into. And I walked into a betting shop, not really knowing what I was doing or letting myself in for. I placed my first bet. And as I describe in the book, it was a winning bet, which I think probably does have an impact on people, and certainly did on me, because the type of person I am, I think. And I think what's really scary is from that moment on, not a day went past for the next 12 and a half years where I didn't have a bet, either online, in a shop or in a casino. And again, like a lot of people, I was gambling initially probably more than I should have done, sometimes in secret, which I think was a sign in itself, but it was affordable, if you like, both in terms of time and money. As a student, I was being paid to play cricket at the time because I was also a professional cricketer. Then I went back to Northamptonshire where I was playing cricket, and I got released at the end of my first year at university. And that was a really significant moment in my story and journey, because I found that really tough emotionally to deal with. And that point, my relationship with gambling changed, because now gambling gave me something else that I needed, which was this kind of escape. But also it was a way, it was something that I found that kind of replicated some of the feelings I used to get from playing sport at a high level, which I wasn't getting. Carried on at university, gambled more and more, but again, wasn't in any sort of debt because I was fortunate I had more money than most people. I went into the city as an insurance broker. And at that point, kind of my mindset changed because I was surrounded by money. Because that's what was important to people who worked in that environment. And obviously when you're gambling, a lot of it initially or in the early days is a kind of financial drive. And I thought it was a way to make money very quickly. And in 2010, I did. I won a huge sum of money, a life-changing sum of money. But of course, as you just mentioned, Tony, when you win is often when you're most vulnerable, which I never appreciated. And that big win was kind of the catalyst for my addiction, because I lost that money. I didn't tell anybody I'd won it, which I think is a sign itself. And I lost that money very, very quickly. But also that was the point where it almost felt like it had become a drug for me, because if I didn't win that amount of money, it didn't give me the same feeling. And I tried to win that amount of money all the time by putting bigger and bigger bets on. I lost it very quickly. And of course, when you lose it, you then have all the emotions that come with that. You try and win it back. And I just got myself into a real spiral. In 2011, I changed career because I thought if I changed my lifestyle and the environment that I was in, it would get rid of the problem. Of course, now I realized I needed to change me. And I moved out of the city. I moved into the countryside where I became a teacher. I thought the environment wouldn't be conducive to that of a problem gambler and I'd be able to stop, but I couldn't. And then I was earning less money. I had even more time on my hands at certain points because of the holidays, etc. And I just gambled more and more. And I would say one of the weirdest things about a gambling addiction, as you know, is no alcoholic ever tries to drink themselves sober. But as a gambling addict, I always believed that I could get myself out of the problem by gambling. I now realize, of course, it's the last thing that was going to get me out of it, because I don't think any amount of money would have been ever enough. But that's what I was then constantly doing for the next 4 or 5 years was, right, I've got myself into this debt, let's get out of it. And of course, you come, there's points where you sort of win and you come close to clearing the debt, but you need a bit more, or you get yourself into bigger debt and therefore you got to try and win more. And it was just a kind of hole that was just getting deeper and deeper. And bigger bets led to much bigger debts. And then in 2018, as I talk about, I hit rock bottom, and my rock bottom came because I always knew, or I always thought at the back of my mind, I was going to get found out. There was no way I could get away with living this secret forever. I just didn't know when that was going to be. And it took something pretty drastic for it to happen. And that was when I found out that I was inevitably going to lose my house, my job, as a result of things that I was doing. I also thought I was going to face criminal charges, and then desperation really did hit. And that's, as you've just talked about, the point where it became a matter of life and death. And I panicked and I tried to gamble my way out of the problem, and I didn't. And that was the end. And of course, now I'm glad what happened. But at the time, it was really tough because my world came crashing down.
Yeah, and you described the big win and how that changes everything. And I think most people who we would work with, and I know from my own experience and from talking to people over the years, the big win does change your relationship with gambling. Because I remember my kind of the bet that I would say changed a lot for me was in 2005, and when I won €5,000 on a football double. And I remember it was that thing. I told people some of it. I told them that I'd won €500 or €600, not 5,000. And I left in €3,000 into my online account to gamble with. And your relationship definitely changes with gambling because you start seeing it as free money. It's like it goes in this cycle. You see it as free money and you start upping your bets to get that same level of excitement as you described. The tolerance definitely goes up. But then when you lose it, you suddenly realize what €3,000 or could have done, or as you said, what your life changing amount of money could have done. And then you start that whole chase element. But now you have to kind of win big again to fix all this. And I remember even the one thought I was left with when I won this money was for a €50 bet and I won 5,000. Instead of focusing on, geez, I'm after winning loads of money here, which probably was about over two months' wages for me at the time, I was thinking, just imagine if I put 100 on it or 200 euro on it. So it was never quite enough. And then that brings you into this whole cycle. And what I really got from your story as well is it is along that continuum, isn't it? It's kind of like it starts off, we'll always hear it starts off small. There's a big win. It changes your relationship with gambling. It also, I think in your case and in lots of people's cases, it was a way of maybe coping with insecurities, different life events that had a big impact on you. And then you use the gambling as that way to try escape into somewhere where you feel validated or feel better. But then, of course, that has a double-edged sword because it creates a lot more problems. And it is that kind of snowballing effect into oblivion, I suppose, for want of a better word. It's kind of, it really goes on this journey, and it's very hard to stop that once it starts, until, as you said, it gets that place at the rock bottom. And you kind of do know, when you said that about, you do know that it's coming, you do know it's going to come to a head. Somewhere deep down, you know it. But you can't think rationally about it, because even though I could see my own story, I knew it was going to end up where it ended up, or worse, as you said, in your own case, or in my own case as well. But it's that you always believe in some shape or form you can gamble your way out of it. But at the same time, even if I had gambled my way out of it and got the money back, the situation that you found yourself in probably would have still been the same. You might have still faced losing your job because of what you had done within the job. So it's kind of, we nearly rationalize, even at that stage, we nearly rationalize the decision to keep going. And that creates so many more, so much more afterwards. I was also a little bit taken back in the book, because I know you for a couple of years. We met a good few times, and I would have never really heard your story. So I'm getting a real insight into Patrick, the person that I wouldn't have not been aware of, the fact that you used alcohol as well as that as a coping skill. I wouldn't say it was problematic. That's what I'm getting from the book, that it wasn't, we'll say, an addiction, but it was definitely went hand in hand with the gambling as a way of escaping into moments where you could just switch off. And then also with the accident in South Africa, wasn't it, the accident was in
the, yeah, that's right,
taxi. I didn't know that, and I was very taken back about how you describe how that had a big impact on that traumatic event, had a big impact. So maybe you might just give some of the listeners an idea of maybe those two situations.
Yeah, I think it's interesting what you said about kind of alcohol and what drinking did to me. Alcohol almost became medicinal for me whilst I was gambling. I always say when I couldn't turn to gambling, I always used to turn to alcohol, because alcohol used to make me feel better. Of course, it did in the short term, never in the long term. But I think alcohol was the thing that I found that made me forget about what I'd done. So if I had just lost a huge sum of money or borrowed a large sum and lost it very quickly, I couldn't face dealing with that there and then emotionally. And often, well, I can't gamble because I don't have the amounts of money that I need to. So I'd go and drink and I'd suddenly feel better. And then, of course, you wake up the next day and you feel even worse. And then you turn to one or the other. And I realize now that my relationship with it, I was obviously drinking for the wrong reasons as well. It was to try and kind of sedate the feelings that were coming from gambling. Socially as well, it kind of gave me a bit of an armor, if you like, when I was out with mates and you were going through all this. If I was drunk, there was an excuse for kind of behaving irrationally or doing certain things, and for me that was useful. Of course, now people read the book and they think, oh wow, that makes sense. I can now see why you were like this while you were kind of drinking. But yeah, I think that goes hand in hand with a lot of people, and I'm aware of quite a few people that struggle with one or the other, and the two are often interlinked. I know some people who struggle with alcohol, and gambling then becomes part of their life, because as soon as they've are drunk, it kind of gives them this feeling of invincibility that they're then going to win money. And yeah, I think the two often are interlinked, and they certainly were for me. The second question with regards to the accident in South Africa, it wasn't something that I talked about a huge amount. I'm writing the book. It was one of those things that I found quite difficult to talk to. People were aware of it, but I found quite difficult to talk to people about. And actually writing it was quite cathartic and made a big difference. But yeah, in 2015, I was in Cape Town for a wedding, and I was involved in a serious car accident where the taxi driver tragically lost his life. And I was drunk in the front of the car, so fortunately I didn't actually see it unfold. The irony is that probably helped me, because I didn't know what was about to happen. And when I woke up, I witnessed what I saw, and ambulances around me, this complete carnage. But weirdly, with my addiction, I didn't want to talk about it. I almost just shut it out. I didn't want to seek help. I think now, God, anybody who goes through that needs therapy, needs support. But I was thinking, do you know what? I'm going to push that away, because I almost felt like if I did that, it might start to open up other issues. And so I felt like I was almost protecting my addiction and gambling, which looking back is sad and shows the power of the addiction. And I tried to deal with that all myself. And for a short period of time, I was dealing with the trauma that came with that, also my gambling, and my world just became madness, really. And people who've read the book say to me, "God, I had no idea you went through that, but also I can't believe that you didn't sort of get some support or help." But I think that's what the addiction does to you, because I was protecting that rather than me. So yeah, it was a huge moment, and I think that really was the kind of a big turning point. I talk about sort of certain stages, certain events that happen along that kind of 13-year journey, and that was definitely one of them towards the end. And I think what kind of turned it from being a serious problem into something that became sort of life-threatening.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to say that if I did open up and talk about a traumatic event, that it might lead to me having to open up and talk about other things. And it is like, I love the way you describe it, it's a way of protecting your addiction, because you protect that gambling addiction right up until the end. You don't want to let go of it. And it's like that last piece. I think we'll all, you know, if you look at GA, it's about accepting that you have a problem and letting go and surrendering. And it's always, I think that's the key, is to let go, isn't it? Is the key is to let go of that addiction. And I love the way you just said, yeah, it's kind of, I was protecting it. And in lots of ways, I know I can really relate to that, protecting my own behavior, or maybe even that you can rationalize it. But it's that thing of you box off and just leave to the side. But then when I went through treatment, it all came flowing out, and then you become nearly, you know, you nearly become nearly free with everything, that everything comes flowing out. And that can be scary for someone who might be using addiction as a way of coping with kind of negative emotions. It can be very scary to open up those boxes and unpackage that. And I suppose when we were writing the book a good few years ago as well, it is therapeutic writing it. It's tough. I know when I was reliving the Carrickfergus space, where I was kind of, you know, I wasn't in a great headspace, it is tough. I had to stop a good few times and say, listen, I'll get back to you in a few days, because it does bring it back up. And also when, you know, I'm with your work with Epic, you do a load of school talks, and I'm doing a lot of school talks at the moment as well. And I suppose the question I was going to ask, because sometimes when I'm doing the school talks, like, you probably relive your story, you know, more than most people in recovery, and I probably do the same. How do you find that process? Because sometimes I'd be fine, and then other times when you're telling the story, you won't quite tell it 100% the same each time, and you might add a little bit in. You know, you'll generally have your kind of your slides, and you'd follow the slides of what the story is. But sometimes I get really hit with a kind of a moment of, of, like, every time I mention the figures, there's a kind of a tingle goes down my spine, because I kind of got, how did I get to this? And I'm sure you're the same. How did I get to the point where it did get to? But also at times, it can be really tough to relive some of the moments within it, even though for yours, it's kind of nearly four years on. And with mine, it's a little bit longer, but it still brings you right back to that moment. Do you find that difficult at times, or do you find it therapeutic at times, or a mixture of both?
Yeah, I'd definitely say a mixture of both. It's one of those things that you never really know how you're going to kind of respond, as you said, but also sometimes certain environments or things that are going on outside of work will impact that. I think the bit for me that is always the bit that kind of gets me, if you like, is when I talk about my family and the impact that I had on them. And I talk about the fact that, obviously, and I think it's really important that people understand that, is you're often, you become very selfish and you think only about yourself. But actually, when you talk about the impact that it had on other people, the way they suffered, and the kind of harm that I created for them through my addiction, is the bit that they always find difficult. Of course, when you relive that kind of moment where it was make or break, is difficult as well. And the more you do it, the easier it becomes. But I always say to people, it's my form of therapy because I'm sharing. It's a constant reminder of what I went through, what I did, where I don't want to be back. And it's good for me, and it's hopefully good for other people. So I always see a positive, as tough as it can be at times.
Yeah, just while you were speaking there, I think it's when you're in front of people and you're doing your story, whether it's via Zoom or in person, if you pick up on the crowd or on a certain person and you can see them really being impacted by the story, that brings it right back. I think that's when it really hits me, because you reconnect back, as you said, with how it must have impacted other people. And I think, like, to talk about gambling addiction is a kind of it's a thing that you do a lot on your own for so much. And then when it does come to light, it's only then you realize the impact it has on other people. I think that's when I'm at my most vulnerable, when I'm kind of reminded of that, you know, of whether it's directly or indirectly. If I'm reminded of that, that's when I feel at my most vulnerable. And that's when I think that's when it comes up for me when I'm doing the talks. If you pick up on someone who may be a little bit upset by it, or someone who might be, you know, has maybe been impacted by it, I think that's when it really hits me. But it is therapeutic at times. Like, it is, you know, it can be draining at times too, because you're reliving. Because I often wonder, like, we work in an area where you're in living recovery, but you're also talking about gambling probably most of your days as well. So my kind of day or week would be, you know, gambling probably 6 days a week, or 5.5 days, or 5 days a week, whatever it might be. I often wonder what my life would be like if I didn't work in the area, what my recovery would be like, because it is a big part of my recovery is connecting with people who have gone through something similar, or sharing my story, as you were saying, sharing can really help the process too. So it's very interesting to kind of, I'd be always wondering what would my life be like if I was working in another area, what would my recovery look like? Would I have the discipline to stay connected to the supports that are out there, like GA, like counseling, like meetings, or I often wonder that at times. So I'm luckily I don't have to think about that too much, because I'm constantly being reminded by other people's stories about their journey as well. And that connection to that can really help me to remain grounded in my recovery, which I'm sure is the same for yourself and many others who, you know, who are brave enough to share their stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the interesting things there is it almost there's positives and negatives. I always say to people, what's strange about the life I lead now is for 12 and a half, 13 years, gambling consumed me and monopolized my life. And yet it still does in a different way. And I spend every day now talking about gambling, although I'm not doing it and trying to stay off it. And I think that's weird. Whether that's sustainable forever, I don't know. But at the moment, it's that whole feeling of, well, it's good for me and it's good for other people. I also think, particularly in the early days of your recovery and whilst you're further down the line than me, it's still reasonably early on. I think it's that kind of feeling of giving a bit back after taking an awful lot away, almost sort of that kind of service. And that for me is an important motivation for me. Ultimately, I do it because, as much of a cliche as it is, I don't want anybody else to go through what I did. But it's an interesting kind of question, as you say, about, well, what would recovery be like if gambling wasn't still such a big part of your life, albeit in a completely different way. But that reminder is important, but whether you can sustain it forever, I don't know.
Yeah, and I often wonder, like, I think the big difference is when you wake up on a Monday morning, your bank balance is relatively the same as it was on a Friday evening, but also your headspace is a little bit better, a lot better. And I think it's the same at watching sport. Like, I know you're a big sports fan, Barry's a big sports fan, I'm a big sports fan. And it's the ability to be able to watch an event win, lose, or draw, and then your bank balance is still the same today, or the moment after it finishes, or your headspace is relatively the same. Like, if I watch Liverpool, I know you're a Liverpool fan as well, and you know, you'd watch them, and if they do lose, you'd say, well, I've enjoyed the experience of watching it as for what it is, versus you're watching Scunthorpe and Doncaster on a Tuesday night for the sake of watching it because of gambling. And next thing, it's kind of like it's your headspace is totally different afterwards. Like, and it took me a while to be able to watch sport in a way that I really enjoyed it as much as I did pre-gambling, I suppose. And I suppose gambling I did enjoy, you know, in the early stages of gambling, for many, it did enhance the experience. But when I think it becomes a problem, I didn't enjoy sport for a long time. It took me a while to really get back to enjoy it. Did you find that as well? Because I know from playing sport, but also from watching a lot of it, did you find it took that little bit of time to get back to that place where you loved it for what it was? And that definitely came true with your cricket journey. Because I think, as far as I'm aware, just from your social media posts, you're back playing and captaining a team as well. So, like, you go from professional to kind of playing at a probably slightly lower level than professional, but still it seems now that you're back enjoying it for what it should be, for something that enhances your life. And what would your kind of experience of that would be?
Yeah, definitely from a watching point of view, it did take a bit of time to adjust to that, because I always associated the two together. What you just said is exactly right. I think back to when I used to watch a game of football. I wouldn't actually watch the game of football because I'd be constantly gambling on it or something else. So you don't actually watch it or enjoy it. You're actually just gambling whilst you're doing it. And it's sort of on in the background. And now you watch it and appreciate it for what it is. I think the stress that comes with it, as you say, as a fan of certain sports teams, I watch it now, and if they lose, I'm disappointed. But it's nowhere near like the feeling of losing huge amounts of money or what the consequences of that are going to be. I used to bet a lot on emotion as well. So I used to kind of gamble against teams that I supported. So I saw it as a kind of win-win situation. And I think now, well, that's just not sensible, apart from anything else. So yeah, I definitely took time to adjust, being quite or very impulsive. It was like, well, I can't just watch and do nothing else at the same time. But now I do, and I appreciate it and love it for what it is. And I do go and try and watch live sport as well, rather than to spend my money doing that rather than gambling, because I love that feeling, and that gives me a kind of rush and buzz with the atmosphere in stadiums. And that's been a really big thing for me in terms of playing sport. That's been massive in my recovery. Sort of physical exercise has been really important for my mind and my mental health, because it gives me that release, that outlet. Because I played sport at a high level, I'm very competitive. And so I do need that kind of fix, if you like, and gambling gave me that for a while, but now I get it in a much healthier way and enjoy doing it for what it is. So absolutely, it's a really important part of my recovery, but it's so nice to have it without the stresses that come with it. And I think if you are in the situation that we're in, it's understanding as well that whilst sport and gambling now seem to be intrinsically linked, you don't have to gamble to enjoy sport. And yet I think there's this kind of belief that you have to. And hopefully we're testament and proof that that's not the case.
Yeah, I made a slight foray back into doing a little bit of playing football myself. And Friday night at 47, I went back playing a bit of AstroTurf, and I just decided that I'm just too old. I wasn't able to walk for 2 days. I think I pulled my calf, my ankle again. But I enjoyed it, and it kind of gave me that appetite maybe to try, get a little bit more. I think I know that fitness was being a big part of your recovery, and you've ran a marathon or two. I'm not sure how many, but you've definitely ran one anyway. And I know that was a thing that you started doing during the lockdown, that was to work on your physical health. I know that following your social media feeds. But definitely, I think for me, it's a big part of recovery, trying to do things that I enjoy to do, trying to get that balance in life, trying to do that self-care, which I don't always get right, as Barry will know from I'm always giving out to him about my own self-care. I think it's important to get that balance of kind of exercise, diet, rest into your recovery. And just on the subject of enjoying watching football again, I'm going to bring Barry in because I know he's enjoying watching Man United again playing, because he's had a rough run for a while. So I'm going to bring Barry and see if you have any kind of questions or thoughts, Barry.
Yeah, I mean, you're covering a lot of great stuff there already. I suppose one of the things that I always interested to know from anybody in recovery is, you know, what was that kind of rock bottom moment that was the wake up call to say, well, look, this has to end. The gambling has to end. I have to stop doing this. I mean, what was that for you, Patrick?
Yeah, for me, it was the moment that I thought about other people, not just myself. That was the big turning point for me. It's fairly well documented through my story and obviously in the book that I'd reached a point where I didn't want to be here anymore. But just before doing the unthinkable, I reached out to my younger brother. And his reaction was one which triggered something in my mind that hadn't been for a while, which was, well, it's not just about you. What about us? And for me, that was a big turning point. But also the fact that it was almost this kind of, look, whatever it is, we'll help. We'll find a way out. And it just gave me that little glimmer of hope, that belief that there was a way out. And at that point, until I did that, until I admitted it, I couldn't move forward. During the few years leading up to that, there were plenty of other people that wanted me to stop or come clean about whatever it was that was going on, because a lot of people knew something wasn't right, but they didn't realize it was gambling or didn't think it was gambling. But until I was ready, it wasn't going to happen. And as Tony mentioned earlier, that acceptance of, look, I can't do it anymore. I think the other element was pure exhaustion. I talk a bit about at the end when I'd lost that bet, I had basically no money. And I managed to find a little bit of money. I mean, we're talking £18 sterling, and I thought about going to the betting shop, and historically that's definitely what I would have done, but at that point I didn't, because I never wanted to see another betting shop or betting slip in my life, because I was done. I was so exhausted, I was so tired, and those were the kind of two big moments for me that were that kind of rock bottom, that realization. And of course, I think we talk a lot, you hear a lot of people in recovery, a lot of people doing the work that we do on the education and prevention side, that you guys do on the treatment side, and Tony, a bit of both, about telling someone and reaching out for help. And that is the best thing you'll do. But I think it's also understanding that that doesn't solve the problem. It's not all, oh, you just have to tell someone, it's all gone. But once you make that step, once you do that, it gets easier from there. That's the biggest hurdle. And once you got over it, it gets easier from there.
Yeah, and that is great advice. And certainly telling someone is not a cure, but it's the start of that process to start working towards recovery, which is a process that can take a lot of time. And especially, you know, we don't want to, none of us are given the impression that this is kind of simple, or to try and simplify things. Some people's situations are very complex. And like you mentioned, there may be the potential of criminal convictions, there could be massive amounts of debt, and there could be a lot of stuff there. But I suppose the one thing that's, I think, so important for people to remember is that the hope that you think gambling is giving you to resolve all those financial problems is never, ever. Well, I've never met anyone who gambled their way out of a gambling problem. It's not a runner. You mentioned earlier on, nobody drinks their way out of a drink problem. Nobody that I've ever met, and I've met a lot of people with gambling, quite severe gambling problems, I'm yet to meet a single person who gambled their way out of it. I've met people who gambled their way back into the black temporarily. I've met those people, but I've never met anyone who gambled their way out of a gambling addiction, because you can gamble your way financially back into the black. But then if you're addicted to gambling, you're just inevitably going to gamble your way back to zero, and on and on and on and on until you seek the help that you need. So, I mean, that is the first step, and it's an extremely important step. And obviously we'd encourage anybody listening to make that step. Beyond that, I mean, what helps you in your day-to-day, in your recovery or early stage recovery? What would be the most important things for you?
Yeah, there's lots of things that I do now. Obviously going through the treatment and the rehab process that I did was important for me. I was in a protected environment, which is where I needed to be, sort of short term. In terms of how I manage it now, part of it for me is a mindset thing. Acceptance that I can't do it is huge. And taking ownership of that, I use the analogy, if I was still a smoker and a doctor said to me, look, if you have another cigarette, you're going to die, I wouldn't have another one. And I kind of adopt that mindset when it comes to gambling. I just come to understand and realize that I'm somebody who can't do it. That doesn't mean that you don't have the reminders that you could do it, whether that's from your own situation because you've still got debts, or because you see something on the TV or hear something on the radio, whatever it might be. So you have to keep managing that. Talking is huge for me, being open about my emotions. Previously, I would have, if something else was going on, I would have hidden it. I would have escaped to gambling. Drinking is using that as an outlet. Now I talk, whether that's to my wife or to somebody in my family or to somebody in the fellowships, that makes a huge difference. I talked a lot about physical exercise because that's good for my body and good for my mind. I do a lot around kind of mindfulness, and that comes in all sorts of different ways. Gratitude is really important. And of course, the work I do day to day, that kind of sharing. As Tony said, it's about getting that balance right, because you have to also exercise an element of self-care. Sometimes you can become so worried about other people that you forget about yourself. And you've got to keep your side of the street clean, as it were, in order to help other people. So I think just having the awareness of it and managing it, but also being at peace with the fact that some days are more difficult than others, and you have to work on your recovery more when that's the case, and never being complacent. I think the second I get complacent and think, well, I've cracked this, that's when I'm probably most vulnerable. So yeah, long-winded answer to the question. But I think the other thing about recovery, which I feel really strongly about, is everybody's got their own opinions. Everyone does their own thing. But I honestly believe you got to do what's right and what works for you. There is no right or wrong way. There's certainly things that I would advise, and there's obviously things that you can't do in recovery, but it might be that running or is huge for one person. It might be the worst thing for somebody else. You work out what's right for you, and if it works, stick to it.
Yeah, and that's great advice, and it's not long-winded at all. And there was lots of really good stuff in there, and look, we could talk for hours on end about what works and the fact that I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all approach that kind of works universally. Certainly, I haven't come across it, and people have to find the things that work for them as individuals in their recovery. I think the one thing that is universal, though, is you can't let the complacency creep in. You can't start telling yourself, sure, I'm 2 years in, I got this cracked, I could do a small bet at the weekend, you know, well, this time it'll be different, blah, blah, blah. That's how 99.9% of relapses happen, is with that kind of shift in mindset and talking yourself into trouble, you know, through that complacency bit. So I think that's the universal one. But the other elements of it, I think, obviously people can pick from the menu of things that suit them the best in their lives that are going to be realistic for them. Tony, any more thoughts or questions for Patrick?
Yeah, just to come in finally on what you were saying about, you know, you've never met anyone who's been able to kind of gamble their way out of a problem. I always think of the film War Games from years ago, where in the final scene, I think it's Matthew Broderick is playing tic-tac-toe, or the computer is playing tic-tac-toe. And they turn around and say, the only way to win is not to play. And I think that always stuck with me when I watched it years ago. But it also, I think it really resonates now, is the only way for me to win at gambling is not to gamble. And I think it is about building in different elements into your life. Like, recovery for me is not just about not gambling. It's about learning how to enjoy life again, learn how to enjoy the small things, whether that is just sitting, having a cup of coffee on your own, or engaging with your family, or watching a sports event, or whatever that might be. That's the most important part. And to find a way to incorporate that into your recovery. It's not just about how many meetings you attend. It's about getting that balance of what works for you into your recovery. I think if that is the case, recovery is definitely possible, but recovery can also be very enjoyable, because, you know, a lot of people think this recovery thing is hard work, but a lot of people just see it as just hard work. It has to be something that's enjoyable. And that, I think that's what sustains it, getting that balance of, you know, pushing yourself into an uncomfortable situation of talking about things, and making that your go-to place to talk to people about your problems, but also to incorporate the fun things back into your life. And my life is fairly simple at the moment. You know, I enjoy watching a bit of sport, listening to a bit of music, doing the odd bit of exercise. And I really enjoy what I do work-wise most of the time when I'm not burnt out. But when I'm out of balance, all that becomes a chore. Even listening to music sometimes becomes a chore. So I think that's a really, really important part. And just to touch briefly on the analogy you use around the, if the doctor told you if you smoked one more cigarette, a lot of times, if your life isn't great, you might choose to smoke that cigarette because you don't care. And I think that's where you would have been in addiction. So I think in recovery, you see what life can be, and and that's what you want to live for. You want to live for your family. You want to live for moments of enjoying a cup final at the weekend, or enjoying watching sport for what it is. But it takes a lot of work to get back to that place where you get that enjoyment back into life. And for me, that's the essence of recovery. And how anyone finds that space or finds how to get there, it is a personal journey. But there are suggestions along the way from professionals, from kind of therapeutic models, but also from people who've gone through this. The lived experience element is a huge thing of, this is what you can do. We're not saying this will fix it, but this is what you can do to help you in recovery. And same with GA and all the other brilliant supports that are out there. And again, just, you know, it's brilliant to see that the book in Waterford there last week, I sent you a picture of it. I was in the bookshop, the local bookshop, and it was there front and center. Probably where mine was probably a couple of years ago in that section, which is brilliant to see. And I took a picture and sent it. And I think it's an important read. It's an important read for anyone who doesn't understand gambling addiction, or important read for anyone who may be going through it. And it's great to see, you know, more books and more podcasts and more people talking about this hidden problem. And just thanks for writing and for sharing your story, and look forward. I was hoping and I was trying to get it all read before we were chatting today, but I'm really looking forward to finishing it off over the weekend, and hopefully meeting up soon in person for a cup of coffee and a chin wag about the experience of writing, because it is tough to put yourself out there, first and foremost speaking about it, but when you put it out in print, it is tough because it's, you have to be mindful of the impact it has on other people around, especially when you're sharing stories that maybe they may not have been aware of all the details. So for that, I congratulate you for writing it, and it's a brilliant piece of work as well, and it's a brilliant book, and I'd advise anyone who hasn't read it to go and buy it and pick it up and read it. And yeah, so that's all I have to add, Barry, unless you've anything to come in finally with.
No, that's brilliant. And Patrick, I just wanted to thank you again, and I will be getting my hands on my own copy of the book, which is in our local bookstop here in bookshop here in Waterford, and in all good bookstores and online, and I'm assuming Amazon and all those good places for people who are too lazy to go out to a physical bookshop anymore. The book is called Might Bite by our guest today, Patrick Foster. Did I say Foster or it's Foster, not Forster. Yeah, Foster. Jesus, I just had a brain fart there. This is what happens when you get old. Patrick Foster, the book is called Might Bite. And yeah, I mean, for anybody in Ireland who might have seen a section of the book by Patrick in the Irish Times recently, it'll give you a sense of, yeah, what an intense story of addiction recovery this is, and how brave Patrick is and so many other people who've kind of gone out there and told their stories, whether it's in the kind of classroom settings where Patrick and Tony do it, or in print where both Patrick and Tony have done it, or in any other way, or even just being able to sit and speak at a meeting or speak one-to-one in the counselling session, just to be able to put that stuff out into the world takes a huge amount of bravery. So thank you so much for joining us today, Patrick Foster, author of Might Bite. Go out and buy it. It'll blow your minds. Thanks and take care. Bye-bye.
The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to gamban.com to find out more.